Hello, this is Ruthie, you need Dad and me. I'm Ruthie.
And I'm Dad.
I said on the bus that I have thought of something. I've had a great thought. I'm a student at the University of York, by the way, if you did not know. And anyway, I've thought of a lot of different comparisons for what university life is like. It's like being at primary school, it's like Love Island, it's like any reality TV show, really. But I think I know exactly what it's like. I studied Latin at high school, and we had to do Roman civilization. And one of the things we learned about was Bacchus, who is the Roman god
of wine
and theatre.
It's Bacchanalia.
Yeah. Anyway, so which most people probably know. And this is not the whole of university, but on a Wednesday night, it's sports night. So everyone dresses up. Tonight I'm a footballer. Last week it was farmers. The week before was Love Island themed. Like, they're various different fancy dressings. Next week is jungle. Anyway, and so everyone dresses up. And everyone goes to the same club, which is Salvo's. And it is just like this thing we learned about that was called Bacchus, like the Bacchus Festival.
It would be Bacchanalia. That is the festival, is Bacchanalia.
Well, where all the rich elite classes would dress up as peasants and basically dance around naked, and there was no rules, and it was just like very, anyone could do whatever, because these Wednesday nights are so kind of like without a moral societal world. It's like a different, it's because it's all students and everyone's dressed up, so you dress up as people that you're not, which is the same thing as they do. There's a whole bit about Bacchanalia, which is like a Bacchic wand, and they like hit people. It's very strange. That doesn't happen, but this is exactly what a Wednesday night out is like.
And everybody's quite happy with that, despite the inappropriateness of it and everything. And there's no...
Because it's not... You wouldn't on another night.
Or so all the rules are suspended
the
for one
The rules
night.
Are suspended every Wednesday.
Yeah.
Because you dress up as different people.
But what about...
Which is the same. And it's also like we're these university students who should be generally, you know, quite intelligent. And
woke,
we should be
work.
And then... Which is very similar to this elite class that they used to have in Roman times. And then they would dress up as if they were peasants, which in a way we kind of do, because we ignore the fact that we should be more dignified.
So going back five or six podcasts, those Durham students who dressed as government people against the miners.
Oh, Margaret Thatcher and the miners.
Margaret Thatcher.
They
and
didn't
the
actually
miners.
End up doing it. They were told
no,
they weren't allowed.
But in actual fact, perfectly okay, because rules suspended for the Bacchanal or the Bacchanalia.
Now, what do you have on your mind, Dad?
What I have on my mind is family. This is a very sort of family-themed podcast, and I'll tell you why. I mean, we do the two sides of it, your university side, my empty nester side. And a guy called Mark Iverson tweeted, I read something today that said, by the time your children leave for university, you have already had around 95% plus of the time you will ever spend with them. He says, that's a horrible thought. Make every day count.
So you've done? Did you make every day count, Dad?
Well, no, of course nobody did. You know, you all the time, you're, oh, the kids have done this and that and the other. But in actual fact, you should maybe give them carte blanche, because 95% of the time, that's gone. I noticed that, even though fortunately I do this podcast and see you on a Wednesday when we record it, but I thought to myself, the fact you're not there, I mean, some of the time, this 95% of the time, some of it you'll be asleep. And when you become an empty nester, you just walk past an empty bedroom with no stuff strewn on the floor, the bed's perfectly made as it was.
As I always used to leave my room.
Yeah, absolutely. it sort of comes home to you. So I think because the audience, judging by the emails, maybe just the email audience, it's people who've got daughters who are either going to university or will be going to university at some point or are already there at university. I just thought that was a thought that a lot of people would associate with.
Yeah, but then I also think that it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I should have seen, you know, if you have a grandparent that dies or something, oh, I should have spent more time with them or... I should have done this and I should have made more out of the time and blah, blah, blah. But you can't put, like, life on hold because one day it'll be over. Do you know what I mean? You can't... You can't make every day with your children be brilliant or be completely worthwhile and meaningful and stuff, because that was, it's just not how life works. Well, you have to accept that, unfortunately, a lot of the time that you spend with your children will be mundane and frustrating, and it will also be over at some point. And that's kind of just how... I really don't believe in, like, carpe diem. Like, I don't believe in seizing the day. Like, life is not just one day after another. It's the whole bit of it. And a lot of it is really boring, but you kind of have to do that bit too.
But it is a... Well, that's true, but it's a frightening statistic, though, isn't it? That,
yeah, I suppose. But then also...
Although somebody did a tweet, somebody answered this tweet saying, oh my God, you've just got rid of them, and then they come back for the other 5%.
I told my flatmates this fact because you sent it to me in a text, and I said, oh, you know, by the time, blah, 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 and one of my flatmates just went, that sounds comforting.
But I was thinking back to my parents, and I suspect that's 95%, it was probably 97% or something. You know, I used to go back the odd weekend, but because I was working away down south and everything, and I hardly saw the Frasers, which didn't bother me at all.
At Oxford.
I never thought...
Yes, which is my favourite story of your dad.
I don't think I've told it on this, but the story is that my dad used to go out drinking on a Sunday lunchtime with his chums, and at one Sunday lunchtime he said to his chums, well, I'm going to have to go now, because my son Martin, he's up from Oxford this weekend. Neglecting to mention that I was actually in Oxford as a junior reporter on the Oxford Mail. While we're on the subject of parenting, 1 in 10 parents, according to a study, admits to having a favourite child, a survey has found.
Not all so openly on national radio, but...
No, well, we know that's a joke when I say you are the one that I like you all equally, obviously.
Do you like us all equally, or do you love us all equally? Because I think it's very possible as parents to love all your children equally, but not like them all equally.
Well, as we mentioned last week or the week before in the podcast, I have a sort of ranking system, which is very, you know, very precise, and you change positions in the ranking. So Martha is now top ranked because she won an award. So
I don't think you should get points for winning awards. It has to be like nice stuff you do for other people, you know?
But anyway, anyone who's nurtured a lifelong suspicion that they played second fiddle to a favoured brother or sister during childhood may well be right, especially if they have a younger sibling. 1 in 10 parents admits to having a favourite child. A leading psychologist said that the real figure was likely to be higher, because some parents are embarrassed to acknowledge their favouritism. A third of people said that their parents had a favourite child, and most did not think it was them.
You always say that your parents' favourite was your younger brother.
Yeah, I think it's birth order. Birth order is a very interesting thing, because there were three of us.
Birth order is so interesting in terms of, like, just amongst the siblings, like, older siblings are, like, most presidents were older siblings. Like, younger siblings are much more likely to be creative, but also, like, wild and, like, get into trouble more often and stuff.
And the
really
middle,
interesting.
See, I am what my friend Paul calls the spooky middle child, because the middle child is neither fish nor fowl in a way, because the first child, obviously it's the first child, it's the first grandchild is going to be favoured. The younger one is the, like yourself, is the baby of the family and gets cosseted and everything. And especially as the hard part, the hard yards of bringing up children have already been learnt by the time the younger ones.
And then I also think you get a lot more freedom as the youngest child. Like you are allowed, because by this point your parents, like you've talked about when David was a baby, mum was quite like, you know, you're worried about the kid because you don't know what you're doing, blah blah blah. Whereas when she had me, it was like easy. And then it stays with it as you get older, like you're less worried about them going to parties and stuff because the other kids have already done it anyway. So I feel like I was very much allowed to
kind of do
whatever I want.
Indulge in the bacchanalia on a Wednesday night and you don't even have to worry about it. It's brilliant. Also in this study, there's quite an interesting historical or biblical thing. Favouritism has long been recognised. The book of Genesis describes how Jacob fathered 12 sons, but loved Joseph more than all his children.
He got the coat.
And he made him a coat of many colours. The indignant brothers sold Joseph into slavery.
And then in the third book of the Bible, the musical one, it's really good, Joseph.
Oh, you mean the Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Yeah, the Andrew Lloyd Webber.
The book of Andrew Lloyd Webber.
It's Genesis, the book of Ruth, Andrew Lloyd Webber. I mean the book of... I wasn't making a joke about me writing a biblical book. That's an actual book, right? So I was reading an article that said about how it was talking about whether it was still financially beneficial to go to university. The article said, higher pay still makes it financially beneficial to go to university for most students in England, says research from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Mm. But 20% of people are worse off after paying for their costs, says the study commissioned by the Department for Education. Over their working lives, male graduates on average gain by 130,000 and female graduates, do you want to guess how much less it is?
I don't need to guess because I have that report here. Women, 100,000.
This is not that interesting for you then, considering you've already read it.
Well, I've already read it, but I was going to discuss it with you anyway.
Oh.
And just discuss...
Because another line in the thing, for women, the financial gains of studying creative arts and languages are close to zero.
Yeah, well...
So, not my favourite thing I've ever read.
No, well, I looked at it. I didn't see the languages, but I did see the thing about creative arts. Mm. I mean, yours is a more solid degree, isn't it?
Mine's more scientific than that, like... The department is languages and linguistic science. So technically, it's like more like a social science rather than a creative art, but it does say creative arts and languages in the study. We have a, I think language graduates have a really high employment rate, but not a high earning rate. Depends what you go into. Like, you can do diplomatic work, which obviously gets paid really well, but I think a lot of the translation stuff doesn't. I'm not sure. But it's very necessary.
Yeah.
So you always have a job, but...
And as you say, there's a sort of bit of a scientific basis because a lot of it is cultural stuff as well. You learn about the culture of Spain, don't you, and France and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, society. But anyway, the thing that really interested me in this story was how much lower female graduates' lifetime earnings are. The analysis says it is likely to reflect women taking time off or reducing hours when they have children. But... I always think it's unfair that women will then earn less because we take time off, but like if no one took time off, then how did kids get raised?
Mm.
It seems unfair.
Well, yes, it is, strictly speaking, unfair, but then as far as an employer's concerned, they've got to be economically viable. If you're not there doing whatever it is you're paid to be doing, and you're not actually using your degree to do that, from an employer's point of view, if you look at it as purely financial transaction...
No, I understand that. Like, I understand
Society benefits. So the ideal solution would be the government to compensate you for the pay that you're losing when you're not working.
Yeah.
But again, economically, that would be very difficult.
Especially
if you're in a high-paid job.
It does just seem really unfair.
Yes, but there's, I think it's an unfairness
it's a very difficult
that we're going to have to live with.
Forever.
It depends how much we grow economically, but I would have said, yes, more or less forever. I think, you know, we often said when you were kids growing up, that 5% of your time that we spent together, we often said, life isn't fair. And life isn't fair. And it'd be nice if everything was, you know, if life was very fair, you know, there wouldn't be however many thousand people die of hunger every day, which you were telling me earlier on. Is it 13,000, you said?
Yeah, 13,000.
I'm not sure where the statistic comes from. But, you know, if life was fair, people wouldn't be sitting on the streets begging for money.
Yeah, I know, but it just seems...
it seems unfair.
Yeah, it's unfair.
But
and it's annoying.
I thought the internet, well, it's unfair and it's annoying.
And then I also thought, like, what was interesting in that is it is likely to reflect that women take time off for children, which is a really well-known fact, although it still shouldn't be an economic disadvantage to have children, but anyway. But then it also says the gender gap in earnings opens when graduates are in their early 30s, and most people have not had kids yet in their early 30s, not of recent times.
Thirties is. I mean, it used to be 20s. I think now it's 30s.
I think the average age that women have children though is. Should I just Google it?
I would say the average age would be about 27.
I think it's more like 34.
First child.
Oh yeah. Average age for women to become first time mums is 29. So yeah, that does make sense.
Hmm.
Men are 34. God really screwed us with this kind of women have the children and stuff.
The other thing that interests me in this study is how much you look on your degree and on your studying and everything as a financial transaction. Mm. I think we've sort of mentioned this before, and the fact that pretty well everything you read about university these days somehow comes down to money, you know, as opposed to just education for its own right and everything. And I wondered how much you thought of what you were spending and what you were getting. And this obviously comes up with the strikes, and you think, because all the articles about the strikes say, well, if you're losing this much tuition, you're losing, I don't know, £200 worth of tuition or whatever.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether that crossed your mind a lot.
Yeah, it does, because at the heart of it, you read a lot about like mental health at university and this, like making friends and blah, blah, blah. But at the heart of it, it is a business transaction. You're paying for a service like any other thing. And you, it's weird that we don't look upon it as more of a financial transaction.
But they do these days, all the time.
I don't think like you
see,
do as a
uni,
student.
I couldn't, it didn't cost me anything. So
it's because it's so expensive. But I was actually, have been thinking about this a lot, and I read another really interesting article. A guy called Mr. Clark, who is...
Mr. Clark?
No, he's called, I want to say Thomas Clark, but I've only written Clark. I've not written his first name. He was... What?
Well, for God's sake, you're supposed to research this, and you only Mr. Clark, that is pathetic.
He used to be in the Labour Party. He was the one who raised tuition fees to £3,000, which at the time was like...
An outrage,
but now it seems like peanuts. And he said that he rejects Labour's current policy to scrap fees and says he was shocked to see that leadership candidate Keir Starmer is sticking to abolishing fees because... It is a financial thing. Like, you are getting a service, you're paying something to in order to be more valuable to society, and so it should be something you pay for. He said the problem with university tuition as it is, and the problem with why it comes down to money, and it's like the issue here is, he says there's a dishonesty that says all universities are the same. A law degree from every university is of the same value, and I don't think that's true. I don't think people believe it's true, but the universities say it is by charging the same amount. And I kind of do agree with him. University degrees are not worth the same. You shouldn't be paying the same amount for them. Like, you shouldn't be paying £9,500 when you have 2 contact hours a week versus what I have, which is 13. It doesn't make...
It's very difficult to even up.
Yeah, of course it is. And then, like, different degrees take more work behind them, more facilities. But at the heart of it, if we're going to say either you scrap fees and it's no longer a financial transaction, or you admit that it is... Universities are a business. It is paying for a service, and you pay for the service that you get.
Good point.
I think.
Good point.
Although that is also like quite a pessimistic way to view university, but it's a lot of money.
It's realistic.
It's 27 grand.
Yeah.
You know.
So you're agreeing with Charles Clark, the former Labour
Minister.
I do in
some ways.
Charles Clark.
I would like Charles Clark, not Thomas. I think I would love university fees to be abolished, but I think realistically they're not going to be. And he says the problem is he launched the debate on raising tuition fees to £3,000 in 2004. And he said that universities have not helped their case by all charging the maximum fee level. That's not what he intended it to be. He says, I think there is too much sense of entitlement in universities that says they have a right to be supported by society, but you have to demonstrate your value to society. So, like, the government helps fund universities with the tuition fees and stuff because everyone gets loans, but then universities are actually very insular and don't give anything back. He doesn't think that they are getting sufficiently involved in addressing the social divisions seen in the Brexit debates and the challenges of left behind, in quotation marks, towns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Little bit of music?
Little bit of music.
Well, we're going multilingual this morning because I didn't know you would... I mean, I know you told me, but I forgot that you were going to pick...
Because last week I had a Spanish song.
Yeah.
And this week I've got a French song.
And I've got a bit of Spanish. I've got a bit of Tex-Mex stuff, a bit of Mexican. One of my absolute favourite artists. But we'll play yours first.
Hmm.
This is called Balance Ton Quoi.
Donc laisse-moi te chanter. Je passerai pas à la radio. Parce que mes mots sont pas très beaux. Les gens me disent à demi-mot. Pour une fille belle, t'es pas si bête. Pour une fille drôle, t'es pas...
Kind of, so balanced tongue quack kind of means expose your what?
Expose you what?
Yeah, because the song, so it's by a girl called Angèle.
Looks very young from the video. She looked about 10.
No, I think the girl in the video is that, like, the picture is like a little kid. That's not her. Anyway, so the song is really interesting. It's like a really like feminist song, and the video is like a lot of like armpit hair like on show and stuff like that.
The lyrics are great. Love armpit hair.
And the lyrics are really good, like if you look at the translations of them, and there's like a lot of lines that are like, for a pretty girl you're not that dumb, for a funny girl you're not that ugly, a lot of those kind of lines. And it's a really, really good song, so I'd recommend listening to it.
It's interesting because the style of it is very old-fashioned. It's what the French used to call yeah, yeah. That's what it was called. It was called the yeah, yeah style. Because French pop music never been very popular. And when, you know, worldwide, whether it was language or whatever, it never got a worldwide audience apart from one or two artists, Johnny Halliday a bit. But when the Beatles and the British groups were dominating the French charts and British singers, you know, Petula Clark, all sorts of people like that, the French had their own version, which was called Yeah Yeah, because I suppose they wanted to hang on to the Beatles 60s type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
First time I mentioned the Beatles today. But they did all that. And I've got loads of albums in this series. There's one called C'est Chic and Toujours Chic. So I'll let you have some of those because have you worked your way through the Bob Dylan theme time?
Haven't, yeah.
No, well, you must do. But that's a very sort of old-fashioned French style.
Mm.
My song is from a guy called Ned Sublette, who is...
That's his real name?
That's his real name. And he's got an album. It's one of my favourite albums of all time, which is called Cowboy Rumba. I just thought a bit of Spanish would help you out in your studies and everything. But in this little bit, he goes back to his hometown, which is in New Mexico, and they've opened a bar there, and he sees this girl in the bar.
Being the sociable sort, I went up to her and said, hola, ¿qué tal? Which is Spanish for... Yo, what's up? Bueno, estoy aquí, which is Spanish for coolin'. Te pago una copa, can I buy you a drink? Como no, go for it, papi. Como te llamas? What's your name? Me llamo María. My name is María.
Quite basic Spanish, but...
Yeah, that's good if you're very beginner. You can learn a few phrases.
What's your name?
¿Cómo te llamas?
Very good. There you go. So it's all working for you. Ned Sublette, born 1951 in Lubbock, Texas, American composer, musician, record producer, musicologist and author. I mean, he really knows about this stuff. He's written books about Cuban music and everything. He studied Spanish classical guitar with Hector Garcia at the University of New Mexico. So how about that? And with Emilio Pujol. P-U-J-O-L, is that the right pronunciation?
Where's he from?
Spain.
Oh, yeah, Pujol then.
Pujol.
I don't know how it works in Latin America, but there are quite a few different pronunciations. Had a funny thing in French this week. We had to read out loud, and then I said beaucoup, and she went, no, that is what I don't want to hear, because she's unbelievably French, so quite, like, blunt.
Really French?
Yeah. She said, oh, no, that's not what I want to hear. That means nice ass. Beaucoup,
yeah,
means nice ass. Beaucoup is what you should say.
Beaucoup.
Cool.
So it's very...
Well, no, it's just she said, like, you can't let your tongue touch your teeth. So it's not beaucoup, it's beaucoup.
They're so prescriptive about everything, the French.
Much more chill in Spanish. Mm. You just pronounce all the letters.
Got a few emails. This is a really raw email. I said that family is going to be sort of one of the themes, really, of this podcast. And Kirk Steigman wrote to us. He said, hello to both of you. I love the podcast. That's what we like to hear. I have a daughter at the University of York, and that's why I started listening to you guys. Our relationship was great once, but I've suffered with mental and physical health problems in the last few years, and our relationship has drifted apart. Listening to your podcast makes me feel a little in touch with her. I'd love her to know that I love her and miss her very much. I understand the hurt I've caused her, and I'm truly sorry for that. Keep up the podcast. It really gets me through the week. All the best, Kirk, which is a very sort of raw email. Mark Bernstein says, Martin and Ruth, your podcast brought... We were talking Saturday jobs.
I think also that just a little bit on Kirk's email is that relationships between parents and children, I think like when you're with your friends, so I've been doing a lot of thinking about family relationships because I've got a commission for a play thing, and the play is a lot about family, so I've been thinking loads and loads about it. And one of the things I've like, the conclusion basically of a lot of stuff is you fall out with your friends often, and you never know whether that might be the end of the friendship. Like, it becomes strained, you drift away from each other, and there's a potential always there that is it. But I think, like, with family, it's very, very possible to get the relationships back. And you, with parents and children or, like, siblings, you can return to those relationships, and they're not gone, like, because you have, like, unconditional love. As long as, I know not everyone does with their parents, because some parents are awful, but if you do, like, you can come back to it.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. That's a bit of a sort of message of hope, really.
I think, yeah. I didn't want to just say, like, oh, sad times, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's...
It is straining on relationships. Like, I know that our relationship now is, I think, very different to how it was when I was at home, because it's just, you have more ease of relationship, like... It's more easy when you're at home because...
You're there all the time.
Yeah.
Mark Bernstein wrote to us, and he was on the subject of Saturday jobs, if you want to know what it was like in the old days.
I read the headline. It just said that the number of 16-year-olds, or 16 to 18-year-olds with Saturday jobs has halved in the past, like, 2 years or something.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it last week.
Oh, were we?
Yeah, we did the whole thing. That whole thing. Were you not listening?
I thought I did. I read it this morning.
On charge at the time.
I read it this morning. I thought, oh, that's interesting.
Well, it was interesting last week.
Oh, there you go.
Still interesting. He says, your podcast brought back memories for me. He says, I'm now 59, of working in the public cafeteria at Selfridges in the autumn of 1977. I was paid £6 every Saturday. Now, it is interesting because in 1977, Selfridges in Oxford Street would have been not quite a greasy spoon, but just a sort of ordinary calf. Whereas now, I think you went with me to... Selfridges restaurant. We sat there on...
No, we went to, like, there's, like, a Pret or, like, a wasabi, like, inside it. That's where we went.
Yes, but what I'm saying is we sat and had sushi, or I think it was sushi, in Selfridges, either you or your sister, I can't remember which.
Yeah.
But it's now very, very... I mean, there are several little restaurants.
Oh, yeah, because we could see the one, like... Yeah, there's, like, a really fancy, like...
Well, they're all quite fancy. They're all quite fancy and expensive. In those days, it would have been a toasted tea cake and
really?
Coffee.
Even... Don't you think Selfridges has always been, like, fancy?
Not at all.
I mean, it was back in the day. Like, I watched the programme.
Oh, Mr. Selfridge?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fancy in a different way. It was fancy because waitresses had white aprons on and everything and black, and they all wore a uniform, and they came to your table and they served you coffee, which was more sophisticated than tea in those days. But it was basically a toasted tea cake. Mm. It was Selfridges, it was a toasted tea cake. Now there's like four different outlets, you know, going up.
Yeah.
And it gets reviewed in the restaurant columns of papers. My last Saturday ever at work there was Cup Final weekend, 1978. I couldn't find the score of the game until I reached a newspaper stall by Bond Street Station. Those were the days. You had to pick up a paper to find out a football score.
Madness.
Absolute madness. But interesting, that weekend in 1978, when he was doing his final weekend at Selfridges, I was doing a course for teaching people how to use the media. And it meant for the first time in my life I missed the cup final because it was on a Saturday afternoon, this course. So I always remember it was Arsenal versus Ipswich. And I think Ipswich won, but I can't quite remember. But that's the one cup final I'll always remember, 78, Arsenal versus Ipswich. I wasn't able to watch it because I was working. Was mildly interesting, I suppose. He says...
Mildly. Very, very mildly.
Brad Solomon says, love the podcast, been listening since the beginning. Enjoy your banter. It's banter that
banter.
We have. Banter. Banter, pants. Is it really three series old? It certainly is.
Series. We use the term loosely because we don't... imply any rhyme or reason.
No, I might start series four soon.
Just cause.
It reminds me of some of the conversations I have with my 19-year-old, who's about to go to Nottingham University in September. What makes me laugh the most is when you discuss music. I really enjoy your picks, Martin, for the podcast, but I find myself liking Ruth's too, which is weird because as a 49-year-old, I'm sure I shouldn't be enjoying what is essentially a Radio 1 playlist. So it's not at the moment. You know, that one today was fairly old-fashioned, it sounds to me.
Not really, though. Like, the lyrics are quite brash. Like, that doesn't get played on the radio in France, I don't think.
Really?
Well, one of the lines is, like, you won't play this on the radio. I don't know how much it does. Like, I think it would be on the, like, Radio 1 channels. It wouldn't be on, like, Real. Real doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No, in France, Magic, it's called France Inter.
Oh, well, yeah. Interesting.
There you go. Anyway, so thankfully that's what Spotify is for. So thank you very much. Brad Solomon, who's the founder of the CTG Group. I've no idea what the CTG Group is. But
congrats on that.
But yeah, congratulations. It's good to have a founder of anything.
Interestingly, Spotify, I don't know whether you use it enough to have this, but it's done a new thing, which is it'll tell you like whether you're in the top 3% of fans of someone or whatever. Ah. And I got that. I'm the top 1% of fans of Dolly Parton.
Really?
Yeah, I'm in the top 1% of people who listen to Dolly Parton, like the amount I listen and the variety. Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you, thanks.
I am second in the world.
On QuizUp, this is.
On QuizUp.
Which everyone else stopped playing about 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, I'm second in the world on Woody Allen films.
Congrats.
Thank you very much indeed. Are you familiar with the work of Suzanne Moore?
I am not, but she's a Guardian writer,
I
believe.
She's a columnist in The Guardian, and she's a feminist, a very dedicated feminist, and has written a column this week, which I thought was spot on, absolutely spot on. I'll read you what she says as a feminist. She says, I feel a huge sadness when I look at the fragmentation of the landscape, where endless fighting, cancellations and no platformings have obscured our understanding of who our real enemies are. Now, you know, you may have read about the no platforming of Selena Todd. She's a professor of modern...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You will have done. She's a professor of modern history at the University of Oxford. She was due to give a polite 2-minute speech of thanks at an event at Exeter College commemorating 50 years since Ruskin Colleges. Ruskin College, very politically correct, left-wing, all that. Ruskin College's inaugural National Women's Liberation Conference. The day before Todd was due to speak, she says she was disinvited on the grounds that she'd addressed a meeting of the group Woman's Place UK, which was formed in 2017 after proposed changes to the Gender Recognition Act. We have talked about this before. The group campaigns for women to have separate spaces and distinct services on the basis of our biological sex. Todd, an esteemed professor of working class history, has, as a result of giving this talk to them, been accused on social media of being transphobic. Woman's Place UK was recently defined as a trans-exclusionist hate group in a pledge put together by the Labour Campaign for Trans Rights, which Labour leadership candidates Lisa Nandy and Rebecca Long-Bailey signed up to, possibly without thinking about it clearly enough. Woman's Place UK clearly isn't a hate group, and the Labour pledge led to many women using the hashtag #ExpelMe on Twitter, i.e. expel me from the Labour Party, because they were uncomfortable with people being able to self-declare as a man or a woman, whatever their biological sex, for all sorts of reasons. We've gone through the looking glass, is basically what Suzanne Moore says, which I agree with, and are being told that sex is a construct. It is said that sex is merely assigned at birth rather than being a material fact. This is not complicated, she says, nor is there a spectrum, although there are small numbers of intersex people who should absolutely be supported. So what she's saying, A Woman's Place UK is saying, it's not saying trans people, you know, it's not trying to put trans people down. What it's saying is there should be spaces for women who want their own spaces, which seems to be
it's difficult. Yeah, no, I don't think it's a hate group in any sense. Like, I think that's pretty clear. You know, a hate group is like the KKK. Like, it's just completely, I think it's completely irrational to say that. But I do think there is, like, it's difficult to say you want women-only spaces and then exclude trans people from that, because I do believe that trans women are just as much women as biological
should
women.
Should there not be some sort of...
But then, like, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, precisely. That's what I'm asking. Should there not be some sort of cutoff point where you do say...
No, either way.
No pun intended. Should there be some sort of point at which you say you are now a woman, and should it not be...
But, like, which way do you go? So, like, my thing of this is always, like, I think that being a woman is more than just about your ability to, like, have children, you know what I mean? Like, that kind of...
No, I think we're all agreed on that.
So if we're saying that trans women are excluded from these spaces for not being biological women, then what are we saying that womanhood is? Do you get what I mean? I'm saying that trans women should be allowed to be in women-only spaces, but then also I don't want it to become where it's this stupid thing of, like, oh, anyone who says they're a woman can be in women-only spaces.
I think that's all Women's Place UK is saying. And then to be, you know, for someone to be no platform, someone who's...
Oh, I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely... I think it's, genuinely a tragedy. University said they couldn't confirm her safety. Like, it's just unbelievable that it's this like cancel culture that people have now, which is just stupid. Like, I remember my a teacher telling me about how she went to hear Marine Le Pen speak, who is obviously, like, massively right wing and pretty
racist, questionable views.
Yeah. And the university, I can't remember which, like, gave her a platform to speak on. People went, and then they debated with her afterwards.
That's the way to do it, isn't it?
You do, you know, that you open up dialogues about it. It's not saying that, like, if you invite someone, you have to agree with everything they say. It's saying, this person has something interesting to say, let's listen. Like, that's all.
What's your view on it? There's another sort of question that arises as regards trans women, which says, because if they transition in later life, you know, if they transition maybe in their 20s, 30s or whatever, they can't call themselves real women. I'm not saying this, but people do say it, because they've not been a girl and they've not gone through all the struggles that a woman has, say, before the age of 20. Yeah. Etc. etc. So you can't call themselves a woman because they've not had the experience of being a girl.
I kind of disagree with that. I think they have different experiences of being a woman. Like, that's just a different thing. And, like, I don't have the same experiences as a woman from another place. Like, no. You know, girls' experiences, like, yeah, we all go through the same puberty or whatever. It's not the same experience, you know, like. I think that's...
So that's a specious argument as far as
I think so, yeah. Or, like, I think that, like, when you talk about feminism and it becomes, like, very... It's not intersectional, so, like, it doesn't take into account, like, race and stuff.
Do you think that people who are campaigning to be leaders of the Labour Party ought to just think a little more closely before signing up to every good cause that's going?
Yeah, obviously.
And also listen a bit more closely to Bruce Springsteen. Because, have you seen this?
No.
Rebecca Long Bailey has said, if Bruce Springsteen were British, he'd be singing Born in the NHS instead of Born in the USA, not realising that it's about the Vietnam War.
Oh, I don't really know. I know the song, obviously, but I've never really paid attention to it.
No, but if you were going to tweet something, yeah, you'd compare it to, you'd probably have a listen to it, or just, you can get the lyrics up on
Google it. Yeah,
Google it, like we do with most of the things that we discuss.
Think it's also quick now. You know, it was one day when this Selena Todd had a platform taken off her. It's one tweet that she puts out. It's all of a sudden. It's
all
a hit.
It's all
really instant, and that's the problem. Is that no one has, and it's the same thing of, like, just cancelling something rather than giving it the opportunity to discuss. Because you delete a tweet, you delete someone from a platform. Like, that's the problem.
Nando's. You've been recently to Nando's, haven't you?
No, not for ages.
I thought you went to Nando's. Did you not go?
Two or three months.
Ah,
I've been to Nando's.
Your sister went to Nando's.
Oh, jealous.
Recently. Yeah. Do you still like Nando's?
Oh, I still really like Nando's. It's really good.
Did you know that children are using menu items from Nando's as slang for sexual topics?
I absolutely did not know this. I am too old, I think. I'm out of the...
These are young teenagers who are in Nando's.
I think they must be.
Yeah. Well, it's according to an app. You can get an app that monitors what your kids are typing on their phones. It's called Safe to Net. It screened more than 65 million texts from children and young teenagers. It found that girls as young as 10 are using code words from the chicken restaurant chain's menu for explicit sexual language. I won't go through the sexual language, but you can imagine what it is. Peri-peri means one thing and coleslaw means something else. But this to me, so this story was in a couple of papers, but to me, this sounds like SafeToNet, who are trying to flog their app, or have just made up this thing and screened more than 65 million texts. I don't believe them. There's so much stuff in the newspapers that is just, a lot of it's clickbait, you know, but there's a lot of it is PR. Somebody once said, news is what somebody does not want you to print. All the rest is advertising, and sometimes it's quoted as everything else is just PR. And it's amazing how much stuff in the newspapers is just PR. Or on the internet, it's clickbait. And I had this interesting discussion as to where clickbait came from. Do you remember the guy who's just sent us, Mark Bernstein, who sent us that email saying that he had to go out to a newspaper store to buy a newspaper? You'll have seen these in movies. It's basically somebody sits by, or stands up by a stall shouting out what's in the newspapers and everything. And they have what they call a bill, which the bill is the piece of paper, a big white piece of paper, which they scrawl on it, the latest headlines. And we decided that was clickbait before even the internet was invented, because people would scroll on those things. Famous film star dies, and you'd think, oh blimey, I must buy the newspaper.
Which film star?
And you'd find out, to find out which film star died. And then you find out on page 36, there would be one paragraph about somebody who'd had a bit part in one film like 20 years ago. And that was the famous film star. So we decided that was where clickbait was first invented. I used to work in Taunton in a newspaper office, and the evening paper used to go out, and the guy that we call the circulation manager used to scrawl a story on the white piece of paper, the bill that went by the stalls, so that people were outside the shops, so that people would know that was in the paper. And he used to come into the newsroom where we were sitting and say, what's a story that I can put on the bill? You know, what's a story that'll get people to buy the paper that I can put on the bill? And we told him there was a farmer in Taunton, and all his hen houses had burnt down. And these chicks, the day-old chicks that he had in these hen houses, had all perished in this fire. So on the bills, there was 10,000 of these day-old chicks, and he just put on all these bills, 10,000 die in Taunton fire, thinking, you know, so, and that is clickbait, and that's how clickbait works, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, it's just an interesting story for you.
Yeah.
Mildly interesting.
Mildly.
Do you have anything to amuse us with this week?
I have things to amuse you with, Dad.
Oh, good.
I've got a Your Crush. Your Crush, just in case you don't know, it's just where you post anonymous confessions of love at the University of York. It says, RM, you have the same initials as research methods, but you're much more fun. Nice one. Because last week it was a bit rude, I believe. And then I'll get you a Your Fess. So the York Tories Society, this is the big controversy. They're doing a fox hunting themed bar crawl to honour Roger Scruton.
Yes, he was a right-wing commentator, basically. Yeah.
And so people are quite upset about this because it's, of hunting. People don't like, and people don't like Roger Scruton. Anyway. And then I don't really get this because I'm not very up on politics, but this is the Your Fest. If York Tories are doing a fox hunting themed bar crawl to honour Roger Scruton, can the Lib Dems do a dog killing bar crawl to honour Jeremy Thorpe?
Ooh, that's a very old story. It was on the TV. Hugh Grant played Jeremy Thorpe. Interesting story. It was somebody who was having a homosexual affair with Jeremy Thorpe.
I keep meaning to watch this. Hugh Grant thing.
It's really,
is it really good?
Really brilliant. Hugh Grant is just spot on.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because I lived through this.
Yeah.
All the time. He hired allegedly. It's all alleged, but that he allegedly hired a hitman to kill this Norman Scott, who was threatening to reveal the homosexual relationship he'd had with Jeremy Thorpe.
Mm.
And the hitman was a bit incompetent and killed his dog instead of killing Norman Scott.
Oh, see, so that's quite funny, actually.
Yeah, not for the dog.
No. No, the
Norman Scott. The response is quite funny.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was my your fest. Don't really have a meme for you because there wasn't anything that I found that funny. So, and I just thought I won't bore you with anything that is second class.
Don't ever bore me with anything second class, Ruth. Not in this 5% of time that we have left.
Yeah, exactly. Got to make it good.
Make it the best, yeah. Oh, we ought to just give the email address. So the email address is martinandruthpodcast@gmail.com.
That's martinandruthpodcast@gmail.com.
And we do love to get your emails, whether, you know, you're opening up your heart to us or just raising any subjects or commenting on some of the stuff that we've talked about.
So do email. And thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.